Even for those who have not experienced an education in the classics, Greek myths that were devised about 3,000 years ago impinge upon our lives. When David Cameron called a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union, he was warned that he was opening a Pandora's box. An ocean liner was named Titanic, the American space program Apollo. Amazon delivers whatever you need. Footwear is named Nike. My silk neckties, Hermes. And a disinfectant has the force of Ajax. A new book, The Greek Myths That Shape the Way We Think, observes that those ancient stories explore family relationships, how humans relate to alien, possibly monstrous things, how we interact with the gods, what are the origins of the universe, and how we deal with choice. Some myths touch upon, and have certainly been harnessed to, politics. The author of the book is Emeritus Professor of Classics at the University of Bristol, Richard Buxton, and he joins me now. Good evening, welcome to Times Radio.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
There are so many books on Greek mythology, including several that you've written yourself. Why did you think that a new one might be welcome?
Well, the mercenary answer to that is that 20 years ago I wrote a book called The Complete World of Greek Mythology, and for the last 15 years my wonderful publisher has been saying, why don't you write a sequel? So I gave up and did. But that's a very poor sort of answer. A different sort of answer is perhaps more useful to you. I wanted to take eight myths which have become more or less iconic. They're not the only ones I could have written about. Maybe in 5 years' time you'll be interviewing about a book called More Greek Myths That Shape the Way We Think. But for the moment, it's just these eight. What I wanted to do in each chapter was to start from antiquity. As you know, all over the internet, there are all kinds of half-truths about myths. And I wanted in that first part of each chapter to try and be as sound and accurate as I could. Then after that, I wanted to go on to explore how the myths have adapted to different social, personal, cultural circumstances. And in particular, to ask the question, which is raised in my title, through the word think. How can myths help us to think about questions in the world? How have they helped us? How can they still help us? For example, the Amazons. What would it be like to have a society in which women held all the power? Prometheus. What is it like to be able to know the future for certain? What does that imply about your life? The judgment of Paris is all about choice. You remember that Paris, the Trojan herdsman, was asked to choose between the beauty of three goddesses, Hera, Athene, and Aphrodite. Since all goddesses are the same in beauty, all he could do was to choose between the bribes that they offered. And what they offered was power, that was Hera, knowledge or victory, that was Athene, and, well, to put it bluntly, the most beautiful sexual partner you can imagine in your bed, and that was Aphrodite. How do you choose between those options? How have people chosen? You look at the two front benches, Michael, look across the faces and see where would they put their money? Would it be power, knowledge, or the third option? I don't know the answer to that question.
Oh, the answer is one and three.
Yes, quite. And as they say, let's not go there. go on.
Well, I wanted to draw you out on this. I've repeated your list of categories of myth, and that might make them sound quite bland, which they're certainly not. Oedipus kills his father and sleeps with his mother and tears out his own eyes. Medea murders her children. Orpheus, having lost Eurydice, turns to boys and is murdered by angry women. I just wanted to ask you, why are the myths so violent and so extreme?
Well, I think that's what myths do. They don't reflect the world, they refract it. It's no coincidence that at least that two of the examples that you've chosen are from tragedy, but you could also have chosen from comedy. And we get many comic retellings of myths in antiquity and subsequently as well. One of my favourite artists is Honoré Daumier, and I've got several examples of the funny side of myth in his images. But comedy was also one area, one medium through which myths were expressed in antiquity. Hercules, Heracles as he was known to the Greeks, is a perfect example of that. Many comedies put a great deal of emphasis on his gluttony, his huge, monstrous appetite. At one point, he said by one comedian, not only to eat the ox that was being roasted, but also the charcoal on the grill. So it's not only tragedy, which you've been highlighting, it's comedy, it's epic, and everywhere in between. And we get that mix, adaptable mix, in the millennia that follow as well.
I want just for a moment to dwell on the story of Prometheus, to which both you and I have already referred. I may not get this exactly right, but my interpretation is he's a sort of junior god. He brought fire to humanity. In some versions, he created humanity. He interceded for humanity. And he's rewarded by Zeus, who's a very senior god, by being pinned to a mountain where an eagle daily feasts on his liver, which regenerates in time for the next avian meal. And let's hear someone comment on this.
It is a trope as old as literature that any scientific advance is punished by the gods. When Prometheus brought fire to mankind in a tube of fennel, as you may remember, with his brother Epimetheus, Zeus punished him by chaining him to a Tartarian crag. While his liver was pecked out. His liver was pecked out by an eagle, and every time his liver regrew, the eagle came back and pecked it again. And this went on forever.
Now, I wonder what you made of Boris Johnson speaking there to the United Nations back in 2019. He was already Prime Minister. Are you not quite pleased to see Greek myths in common parlance? We have a Prime Minister at the moment who actually refers to Greek myths quite often.
Well, he does, doesn't he? And that's one side of his image, as you well know. The other side is to wear orange or yellow high visibility jackets whenever he can, and or to wear a butcher's apron and to have a glass of beer in his hand. So for the Prime Minister, it seems to me, who had indeed an outstanding classical education, but it seems to me what he's done with it is to erect it into one side of his image, and that side is gravitas, to contrast with the bluff man of the people. This is the brainy toff. Now, you make of that what you will, but maybe we're on dangerous ground there. Let's get back to Prometheus.
Yes.
As you say, 2019 to the United Nations. What he didn't mention, Mr. Johnson, was that serially, Prometheus was a deceiver. Now, I guess that might not have been in Mr. Johnson's interest to mention that side of Prometheus, and he was perfectly entitled to miss it out, because Greek myths are variable, almost infinitely adaptable. They can be made to move one direction or another direction. And so to miss out the fact that Prometheus repeatedly deceived the gods, notably Zeus, is fair enough. Myself, I would find it taking it a step too far to liken myself to not only the champion of humanity, but also its creator. But clearly, Mr. Johnson goes where some of us don't have the courage to go.
Well, I feel pleased that I have led a professor of classics so far from the central theme of his work. Let's go on to more dangerous territory. Renaissance painters tended to use mythical scenes to titillate their patrons with nudes and with scenes of rape and insemination. So do you think the modern woman should be hostile to Greek mythology?
Well, in short, no. And I can think of an absolute string of wonderful names of contemporary authoresses or female authors, Margaret Atwood, Carol Duffy, to name but two. And they clearly feel that there is material within the myths to take them in the direction that they want. We've got Wonder Woman, who is an icon, a modern film and TV icon deriving from the Amazons. There's any number of reworkings in a feminist direction, and intelligently too. So it's simply not true that Greek myths, although in some retellings, they are misogynistic, absolutely no doubt about it. And that takes us back to Pandora. We can have a word about her if you like. There are misogynistic retellings of the Greek myths from antiquity and subsequently, but there are also cases of the reverse.
Let's have another sound cue, a little bit different from the last one.
There once lived a man named Oedipus Rex. You may have heard about his odd complex. His name appears in Freud's index because he loved his mother. His rivals used to say quite a bit that as a monarch he was most unfit, but still in all they had to admit that he loved his mother. Yes, he loved his mother like no other. His daughter was his sister and his son was his brother. One thing on which you can depend is he sure knew who a boy's best friend is. When he found what he had done, he tore his eyes out one by one. A tragic end to a loyal son who loved his mother.
Not a bad summary in 41 seconds by Tom Lehrer, singing Oedipus Rex. So he mentions Freud in that little clip. Does the fact that we know a little bit about Oedipus Rex, is that because the psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud claimed that every boy wished to kill his father and marry his mother?
Yes, I think Oedipus has become iconic in terms which outstrip almost all the other characters that I wrote about in the book. And it's, of course, due to Freud. Freud's theory, as you very well know, has become hugely controversial, not least amongst feminist rewriters of that complex. But still, if you interview a man in the street or a woman in the street and say, what does the name Oedipus make you think of? It wouldn't be the great Tom Lehrer. It would certainly be Freud. But that's a starting point rather than end point. As I'm no psychoanalyst, I'm no psychologist, I'm no neurologist, so I'm not going to pontificate about the details of the Oedipus complex as currently understood. That would be way out of my purview. But there's no doubt that the fact that Oedipus remains a name to conjure with still goes back to Freud.
And may I ask you one last general question before we have one more little bit of fun at the end? We've established, you know, there are many references in today's society to Greek myths, not least in the brand names that you mentioned, that I mentioned. But your book title, is that an exaggeration? Do the Greek myths really shape the way we think?
I was trying to show how they come to modify the way we think about things, but antiquity tells very often a different story from what we think it does. So yes, I do. I'm not arguing that the Greek myths dominate the world as we think of it, but I think they still have a major part to play, both in, what should we say, higher. Let me tell you, Michael, where I am. Have you got 2 minutes?
No, one.
Oh, crap. Right, okay. I'm in Madrid. And I'm here to examine a doctoral dissertation written by a young Spanish scholar. And the doctoral dissertation is about six novels written in English about the experience of young women. One of those novels is called Winter Girls, a marvelous, gripping story. And it takes the story of Demeter and Persephone and shows how it can relate to the modern experience of a young woman who is a victim of eating disorder. And that goes back to the story of the pomegranate seed, which was how the god of death persuaded, inveigled Persephone to stay with him in the underworld. So that's one young woman's experience dramatized in a novel. So it's not the whole of the world, but it's a key part of it, that young woman's experience.
I think that example serves us very well to stand up your point. Your book, Richard Buxton, is called The Greek Myths That Shape the Way We Think. And because we're all a little bit obsessed with Oedipus Rex, we're going to play out with a little excerpt from the Woody Allen film Oedipus Rex, spelt W-R-E-C-K-S.
Sheldon, where have you been? I've been looking all over for you. I was just discussing your problem with these nice people.
Where are you?
Do I know? Look, Sheldon, I've had plenty of time to think about it. Don't get married.
Not here.
Why should you rush in?
This is not the place to discuss it.
Where should I go? I'm here. You think a man his age should get married? They only met 6 months ago.
It depends. If she's a nice girl, why not?
She's nice, but why do they have to rush in? He's still paying alimony.
Mother, stop.
Let them lead their own lives.
I have the same problem with my daughter. They grow up and they think they have all the answers.
How old is your daughter?
26.
You got any pictures?
Home.
Home? I always carry Sheldon around wherever
oh,
I go.
Oh, God, this can't
See?
Be happening.
Here he is.
I need air.
2 years
I need
old.
Oxygen.
And I'm
I need,
not
I gotta get out in the fresh
pictures,
air. I need cyanide.
You can't show oh. pictures. And isn't he a darling? Look at him.
I've got some pictures of my daughter.
That was actually from the 1989 film New York Stories. That's the Oedipus Rex segment, Woody Allen. And as his mother, Mae Questel, still recognisable as the voice of the 1930s cartoon character Betty Boop. This is Michael Portillo. This is Times Radio.